He took her hand and drew it through his arm, turning toward the herbaceous border that lay beyond the terrace. I know just the place. Great. Oh, wait. Maybe I do want something to eat. She lifted a hand and stopped a slave boy coming up to the terrace from the cookhouse with a small covered tray from which an appetizing steam wafted into the air. What's that, Tommy? Can I have some? You have all you want, Miss Bree. He smiled, whipping the napkin away to display a selection of savouries. She inhaled beatifically. I want them all, she said, taking the tray to Tommy's amusement. Roger, seizing the chance, murmured his own request to the slave, who nodded, disappeared, and returned within moments with an open bottle of wine and two goblets. Roger took these, and together they wandered down the path that led from the house to the dock, sharing tidbits of news along with the pigeon pies. "Did you find any of the guests passed out in the shrubbery?" she asked, her words muffled by a mouthful of mushroom pasty. She swallowed and became more distinct. "When Dar asked you to go and look this afternoon, I mean." He snorted briefly, selecting a dumpling made of sausage and dried pumpkin. "Ken the difference between a Scottish wedding and a Scottish funeral, do you?" "No, what?" "The funeral has one less drunk." She laughed, scattering crumbs, and took a Scotch egg. "No," he said, steering her skilfully to the right of the dock and toward the willows. "You'll see a few feet sticking out of the bushes now, but this afternoon they hadn't had time to get rat-legged yet." "You have such a way with words," she said appreciatively. "I went and talked to the slaves, all present and accounted for, and mostly sober, too. A couple of the women admitted that Betty does tipple at parties, though."
"To say the least, from what your da said. Stinking, he described her as, and I gather he didn't mean only drunk."
Something small and dark leapt out of his path. Frog, he could hear them piping away in the grove. Mama said she seemed to be okay later on, in spite of Dr. Fentiman insisting on bleeding her. She gave a small shudder, drawing her shawl round her shoulders one-handed. "He gives me the creeps, the doctor. He looks like a little goblin or something. And he's got the clammiest hands I ever felt. And he smells terrible, speaking of stinking."
"I haven't had the pleasure yet," Roger said, amused. "Come on."
He pushed aside the hanging veil of willow branches, alert lest he disturb some courting couple that had beaten them to the stone bench. But all was well. Everyone was up at the house, dancing, eating, drinking, and planning a later serenade of the wedding pair. "Better Duncan and Jocasta than us," he thought, rolling his eyes inwardly at some of the things he'd heard suggested. Another time he might have been interested to see a shivery and trace all the roots of it from French and Highland custom, but not bloody now. It was suddenly quiet under the willows, most of the noise from the house drowned by the rushing of water and the monotonous chirping of frogs. It was also dark as midnight, and Brianna felt carefully for the bench in order to set down her tray. Roger shut his eyes hard and counted to 30. When he opened them, he could at least make out her form, silhouetted against the dim light that filtered through the willows and the horizontal line of the bench. He set down the glasses and poured out the wine, the neck of the bottle chinking faintly against the goblets as he felt his way. He put out a hand and ran it down her arm, locating her hand in order to put the full goblet safely into it. He raised his own glass in salute. "To beauty," he said, letting the smile show in his voice. "To privacy," she said, returning the toast, and drank. "Oh, that's good," she said, a moment later, sounding slightly dreamy. "I haven't had wine in a year. No, nearly two. Not since before Jemmy was born. In fact, not since..." Her voice stopped abruptly, then resumed more slowly. "Not since our first wedding night. In Wilmington, remember?"
"I remember."
He reached out and cupped a hand round her cheek, tracing the bones of her face softly with his thumb. It was no wonder that she thought of that night now. They had begun it there, under the drooping branches of a huge horse chestnut tree that had sheltered them from the noise and light of a nearby tavern. Their present situation was oddly and movingly reminiscent of that dark and private secrecy. The two of them, amid the smell of leaves and nearby water, the nearby racket of lust-crazed tree frogs replacing the tavern noises. That had been a hot night, though, thick and humid enough that flesh melted to flesh. Now it was cold enough that his body yearned for the warmth of hers, and the scent that enclosed them was the spring smell of green leaves and running river, not the musty smell of leaf litter and mudflats.
"Do you think they'll sleep together?" Brianna asked. She sounded slightly breathless. Perhaps it was the wine.
"Who? Oh, Jocasta, you mean, and Duncan? Why not? They'll be married."
He drained his own glass and set it down, the glass chiming faintly on the stone.
"It was a beautiful wedding, wasn't it?"
She didn't resist as he took the glass from her hand and set it down with his own. "Quiet, but awfully nice."
"Aye, very nice."
He kissed her softly and held her close against him. He could feel the back lacing of her gown criss-crossed under the thin-knitted shawl.
You taste good." "Oh, I like sausages and wine."
His hand twitched up the edge of the shawl, getting beneath and fumbling for the edge of the lace, somewhere down near the small of her back. She pressed against him, making it easier.
"Will we still want to make love, do you think, when we're as old as they are?" she murmured in his ear.
"I will," he assured her, getting hold of the small bow that secured the lace.
"I hope you will, too. I shouldn't have liked to have to do it alone."
She laughed and took a deep breath, her back swelling suddenly as the tight lacing came loose. There were the stays underneath, too, though. Damn it. He used both hands, looking for the inner lacings. And she arched her back, helpfully, which made her breasts swell up into sight just below his chin. The sight made him take one hand off her back to deal with this new and delightful development.
"I haven't got my... I mean, I didn't bring..."
She pulled back a little, sounding dubious.
"You've taken the seeds today, though." Away to hell with pizza and loo paper, he thought. At the moment, he'd trade all prospects of indoor plumbing for a rubber condom.
"Yes." She still sounded doubtful, though, and he gritted his teeth, taking a firmer hold on her, as though she might bolt.
"It's all right," he whispered,
nuzzling his way down the side of her neck toward that heart-breaking slope where the muscle of her shoulder joined it. She was smooth beneath his lips, her skin cool in the air, warm and scented beneath the fall of her hair.
"We needn't... I mean, I won't... Just let me..."
The neckline of her dress was fashionably low with her kerchief pulled off, still lower with her gown unlaced, and her breast was heavy and soft in his hand. He felt the nipple big and round as a ripe cherry against his palm, and bent on impulse to put his mouth to it. She stiffened, then relaxed with an odd little sigh, and he felt a warm, sweet taste on his tongue, then a strange pulsing and a flooding of the... He swallowed by reflex, shocked. Shocked and terribly aroused. He hadn't thought. He hadn't meant. But she pulled his head hard against her, holding him. He went on, emboldened, and pushed her gently backward, easing her down onto the edge of the bench so that he knelt before her. A sudden thought had come to him, prompted by the stinging memory of that entry in her dream book.
"Don't worry," he whispered to her. "We won't risk anything. Let me do this. Just for you."
She hesitated, but let him run his hands under her skirt, up the silken curves of stockinged calf and round bare thigh, under the flattened curve of her buttocks, cool and bare on the stone beneath the froth of petticoats. One of Seamus's songs had described a gentleman's exploits in the lists of Venus. The words drifted through his head with the rushing of the water,
and he was determined to acquit himself with honour in those lists. Maybe she couldn't describe it, but he meant to make sure she knew it had happened. She shivered between his hands, and he cupped one hand between her thighs. "Miss Bree!"
Both of them jerked convulsively, Roger snatching his hand away as though burned. He could feel the thunder of blood in his ears and his balls.
"Yes, what is it? Is that you, Fed? What's wrong? Is it Jemmy?" He was sitting back on his heels, trying to breathe, feeling dizzy. He caught the brief pale gleam of her breasts above him as she stood up and turned toward the voice, tucking her kerchief hastily back in, pulling the shawl up over her unfastened gown.
"Yes, ma'am?"
Fedra's voice came out from under the willow nearest the house. Nothing of the slave showed but the whiteness of her cap floating dimly in the shadows.
"Poor child, he woke up hot and fussin', wouldn't take neither mush nor milk. And then he started in to cough, sounded bad enough. Teresa said we best fetch Dr. Fentiman along to him, but I said..."
"Dr. Fentiman?" Brianna disappeared with a ferocious rustling of willow branches, and he heard the hurrying thump of slippered feet on earth as she ran toward the house, Fed in her wake. Roger got to his feet and paused for a moment, hand on his fly buttons. The temptation was strong. It wouldn't take more than a minute, less probably in his present condition. But no, Bree might need him to deal with Fentiman. The thought of the doctor using his gory instruments on Jemmy's soft flesh was enough to send him crashing through the willows in hot pursuit. The lists of Venus would have to wait. He found Bree and Jemmy in Jocasta's boudoir, the centre of a small knot of women, all of whom looked surprised, even mildly scandalised at his appearance. Disregarding the raised eyebrows and huffing noises, he forged his way through the skirts to Brianna's side. The little fella did look bad, and Roger felt a clutch of fear in the pit of his stomach. Christ, how could it happen so fast? He'd seen Jem at the wedding only a few hours before, curled up pink and sweet in his makeshift cradle, and before that being his usual raucously genial self at the party. Now he lay against Brianna's shoulder, flush-cheeked and heavy-eyed, whimpering a little, with a slick of clear mucus dribbling from his nose.
"How is he?"
He reached out and touched a flushed cheek gently with the back of his hand.
God, he was hot.
"He's sick," Brianna said tersely. As though in confirmation, Jemmy began to cough, a dreadful noise, loud but half-choked, like a seal choking on its fish. The blood surged into his already flushed face, and his round blue eyes bulged with the effort of drawing breath between the spasms.
"Shit," Roger muttered. "What do we do?" "Cold water," one of the women standing beside him said authoritatively. "Put him altogether under a bath of cold water, then make him drink more of it." "No, heavens, Mary, he'll kill the child." Another young matron reached out to pat Jemmy's quivering back. "It's the croup. My lot have had it now and again. Sliced garlic, warmed and put to the soles of his feet," she told Brianna. "That works well. Sometimes." "And if it doesn't?" another woman said, sceptical. The first woman's nostrils pinched, and her friend butted in helpfully. "Joanna Richards lost two babes to the croup. Gone like that."
She snapped her fingers, and Brianna flinched as though the sound were one of her own bones cracking.
"Why are we havering so in a medical to hand? You girl, go and fetch Dr. Fentiman." "Did I not say so?"
One of the women clapped her hand sharply at Phaedra, who stood pressed back against the wall, eyes fixed on Jemmy. Before she could move to obey, though, Brianna's head shot up.
"No, not him. I won't have him."
She glared round at the women, then shot Roger a look of urgent entreaty.
"Find Mama for me, quick."
He turned and shoved past the women, fear momentarily assuaged by the ability to do something.
Where was Claire likely to be? Help, he thought. Help me find her. Help him be all right.
Directing the incoherent prayer toward anyone who might be listening. God, the Reverend, Mrs. Graham, St. Bride, Claire herself, he wasn't particular. He thundered down the front stair to the foyer, only to meet Claire hurrying across it toward him. Someone had told her. She gave him one quick look, asked, "Jemmy?" with a lift of her chin, and at his breathless nod was up the stairs in a flash, leaving a foyer full of people gaping after her. He caught her up in the hall above and was in time to open the door for her, and to receive an undeserved but much appreciated look of gratitude from Bree. He stood back out of the way, catching his breath and marvelling. The moment Claire stepped into the room, the atmosphere of worry and near panic changed at once. There was still an air of concern among the women, but they gave way without hesitation, standing back respectfully and murmuring to one another as Claire headed straight for Jemmy and Bree, ignoring everything else.
"Hello, lovey. What is it, then? Are we feeling miserable?" she was murmuring to Jem, turning his head to one side and feeling gently under his flushed, chubby jowls and behind his ears. "Poor thing. It's all right, sweetheart. Mummy's here. Granny's here. Everything will be just fine. How long has he been like this? Has he had anything to drink?" "Yes, darling, that's right." "Does it hurt him to swallow?" She alternated between comforting remarks to the baby and questions to Brianna and Fedre, all delivered in the same tone of calm reassurance, as her hands touched here and there, exploring, soothing. Roger felt it working on him too, and drew a deep breath, feeling the tightness in his own chest ease a bit. Claire took a sheet of Jocasta's heavy notepaper from the secretary, rolled it into a tube, and used it to listen intently to Jemmy's back and chest as he made more of the choking seal noises. Roger noticed dimly that her hair had fallen down somehow. She had to brush it out of the way to listen. "Yes, of course it's croup," she said absently, in answer to a half-questioning diagnosis offered diffidently by one of the bystanders. "But that's only the cough and the difficult breathing. You can have croup by itself, so to speak, or as an early symptom of various other things."
"Such as?"
Bree had a death grip on Jemmy, and her face was nearly as white as her knuckles.
"Oh."
Claire seemed to be listening intently, but not to Bree. More to whatever was happening inside Jemmy, who had quit coughing and was lying exhausted against his mother's shoulder, breathing thickly in steam engine gasps.
Coryza. That's only a common cold. Influenza, asthma, diphtheria. But it isn't that," she added hurriedly, looking up and catching a glimpse of Brianna's face.
"You're sure?"
"Yes," Claire replied firmly, straightening up and putting aside her makeshift stethoscope.
"It doesn't feel at all like diphtheria to me. Besides, there isn't any of that about, or I'd have heard. And he's still being breastfed. He'll have immunity."
She stopped speaking abruptly, suddenly aware of the women looking on. She cleared her own throat, bending down again, as though to encourage Jemmy by example. He made a small whimper and coughed again. Roger felt it like a rock in his chest.
"It isn't serious," Claire announced firmly, straightening. "We must put him in a croup tent, though. Bring him down to the kitchen. Fed, will you find me a couple of old quilts, please?"
She moved toward the door, shooing the women before her like a flock of hens. Obeying an impulse that he didn't stop to question, Roger reached for the baby, and after an instant's hesitation, Brianna let him take him. Jemmy didn't fuss, but hung listless and heavy, the limp slackness a terrible change from his normal India rubber bounce. The baby's cheek burned through the cloth of Roger's shirt as he carried the little boy downstairs, Bree at his elbow. The kitchen was in the brick-walled basement of the house, and Roger had a brief vision of Orpheus descending into the underworld, Eurydice close behind him as they made their way down the dark back stair into the shadowy depths of the kitchen. Instead of a magic lyre, though, he bore a child who burned like coal and coughed as though his lungs would burst. If he didn't look back, he thought, the boy would be all right. Perhaps a little cold water wouldn't come amiss. Claire put her hand on Jemmy's forehead, judging his temperature. "Have you got an ear infection, sweetheart?" She blew gently into one of the baby's ears, then the other. He blinked, coughed hoarsely, and swiped a chubby hand across his face, but didn't flinch.
The slaves were bustling round in a corner of the kitchen, bringing boiling water, pinning the quilts to a rafter to make a tent at her direction. Claire took the baby out of Roger's arms to bathe him, and he stood bereft, wanting urgently to do something, anything, until Brianna took his hand and clutched it hard, her nails digging into his palm. "He'll be all right," she whispered. "He will." He squeezed hard back, wordless. Then the tent was ready, and Brianna ducked under the hanging quilt, turning to reach back for Jemmy, who was alternately coughing and crying, having not liked the cold water at all. Claire had sent a slave to fetch her medicine box, and now rummaged through it, coming up with a vial filled with a pale yellow oil and a jar of dirty white crystals. Before she could do anything with them, though, Joshua, one of the grooms, came thumping down the stairs, half breathless with his hurry. "Mrs. Claire! Mrs. Claire!" Some of the gentlemen had been firing off their pistols in celebration of the happy event, it seemed, and one of them had suffered some kind of mishap, though Josh seemed uncertain as to exactly what had happened. "He isn't badly hurt," the groom assured Claire in the Aberdonian Scots that came so peculiarly from his black face. "But he's bleeding quite free, and Dr. Fentiman, well, he's maybe no quite so steady as he might be the new. Will you come, ma'am?" "Yes, of course." In the blink of an eye, she had thrust vial and jar into Roger's hands. "I'll have to go. Here, put some in the hot water. Keep him breathing the steam until he stops coughing." Quick and neat, she'd closed up her box and handed it to Josh to carry, heading for the stair before Roger could ask her anything. Then she was gone. Wisps of steam were escaping through the opening in the tent. Seeing that, he paused long enough to shed coat and waistcoat, leaving them in a careless heap on the floor as he bent and ducked into the darkness, vial and jar in hand. Bree was crouched on a stool, Jemmy on her lap, a big white pudding basin full of steaming water at her feet. A swath of light from the hearth fell momentarily across her face, and Roger smiled at her, trying to look reassuring before the quilt dropped back into place. "Where's Mama? Did she leave?" "Aye, there was some sort of emergency. It'll be fine, though," he said firmly. "She gave me the stuff to put in the water. Just said to keep him in the steam until the coughing stops." He sat down on the floor beside the basin of water. It was very dim in the tent, but not totally dark. As his eyes adjusted, he could see well enough. Bree still looked worried, but not nearly so frightened as she'd been upstairs. He felt better, too. At least he knew what to be doing, and Claire hadn't seemed too bothered about leaving her grandson. Obviously, she thought he wasn't going to choke on the spot. The vial contained pine oil, sharp and reeking of resin. He wasn't sure how much to use, but poured a generous dollop into the water. Then he pried the cork out of the jar, and the pungent scent of camphor rose up like a genie from the bottle. Not really crystals, he saw. Lumps of some sort of dried resin, grainy and slightly sticky. He poured some into the palm of his hand, then rubbed them hard between his hands before dropping them into the water, wondering, even as he did so, at the instinctive familiarity of the gesture. "Oh, that's it," he said, realizing. "What's it?" "This." He waved a hand round the snug sanctuary, rapidly filling with pungent steam. "I remember being in my cot with a blanket over my head. My mother put this stuff in hot water, smelled just like this. That's why it seemed familiar." "Oh." The thought seemed to reassure her. "Did you have croup when you were little?"
"I suppose so, though I don't remember it. Just the smell."
Steam had quite filled the little tent by now, moist and pungent. He drew a deep breath, pulling in a penetrating lungful, then patted Brianna's leg.
"Don't worry, this'll do the trick," he said.
Jemmy promptly started coughing his guts out with more seal noises, but they seemed less alarming now. Whether it was the darkness, the smell, or simply the homely racket of the renewed kitchen noises outside the tent, things seemed calmer. He heard Bree take in a deep breath too, and let it out, and felt, rather than saw the subtle shift of her body as she relaxed a little, patting Jemmy's back. They sat quietly for a bit, listening to Jemmy cough, wheeze, gasp, cough, and finally catch his breath, hiccuping slightly. He'd stopped whimpering, seeming soothed by the proximity of his parents. Roger had dropped the cork to the camphor jar. He patted round on the floor until he found it, then pushed it firmly back in. "I wonder what your mother's done with her rings," he said, looking for some easy subject of conversation to break the steam-filled silence. "Why should she have done anything with them?" Brianna brushed back a lock of hair. She'd had it put up for the evening, but it was slipping out of its pins, clinging damply to her face.
"She wasn't wearing them when she gave me the stuff."
He nodded at the camphor jar, set out of harm's way near the wall. He had a clear memory of her hands, the fingers long, white, and bare. They'd struck him, since he'd never seen her hands without the gold and silver rings.
"Are you sure?"
"She never takes them off, except to do something really nasty."
She giggled, a nervous, unexpected sound. "The last time I remember was when Jem dropped his bauby in the chamber pot." Roger gave a brief snort of amusement. A bauby was any sort of small object, but that's what they'd taken to calling the iron ring, originally meant for leading cattle by the nose, that Jem liked to chew on. It was his favourite toy, and he didn't like to go to bed without it.
"Papa?"
Jem raised his head, eyes half closed. He was still breathing thickly, but beginning to display an interest in something besides his own discomfort.
"Papa!"
"Oops, shouldn't have mentioned it."
Bree joggled him gently on her knee and began to sing softly, half under her breath, to distract him.
"In a canyon, in a cavern, excavating for a mine, dwelt a miner, 49er, and his daughter Clementine."
The dark privacy of the tent reminded Roger of something. He realized that it had something of the same feeling of peaceful enclosure that the bench beneath the willows had had, though the tent was a lot hotter. The linen of his shirt was already limp on his shoulders, and he could feel sweat trickling down his back from under the hair tied at his neck.
"Hey."
He nudged Bree's leg.
"Do you maybe want to go up and take off your new dress? It'll be spoilt if you stay in here for long."
"Oh. Well." She hesitated, biting her lip. "No, I'll stay. It's okay." He got up, stooping under the quilts, and gathered Jem up off her lap, hacking and gurgling.
"Go," he said firmly. "You can fetch his you know what. And don't worry. You can tell it's helping, the steam. He'll be right in no time."
It took a bit more argument, but at the last she consented, and Roger sat down on the vacated stool, Jemmy cuddled in the crook of his arm. The pressure of the wooden seat reminded him of a certain amount of residual congestion from the encounter under the willows, and he shifted slightly to ease the discomfort.
"Well, it doesn't do you any lasting harm," he muttered to Jemmy. "Ask any girl. They'll tell you."
Jemmy snorted, snuffled, said something unintelligible, beginning with "bah," and coughed again, but only briefly. Roger put the back of his hand against the soft, round cheek. He thought it was cooler.
Hard to tell, warm as it was in here.
The sweat was running freely down his face, and he wiped it with a sleeve.
"Papa?"
asked a froggy little voice against his chest.
"Aye, in a bit.
Hush now."
"Papa! Papa!"
"Shh!
Ba!"
"Light she was, and like a fairy."
He groped for the words to the song.
"Ba!"
"And her shoes were number 9.
Roger abruptly raised the volume, causing startled silence both inside the tent and outside, in the kitchen. He cleared his throat and lowered his voice back to lullaby level.
"Herring boxes without topses, Sandals were fra Clementine. Oh, my darling, Clementine. Thou art lost and gone forever. Oh, my darling Clementine.
The singing seemed to be having an effect. Jemmy's eyelids had dropped to half-mast. He put a thumb in his mouth and began to suck, but plainly couldn't breathe through his clogged nose. Roger gently pulled the thumb away and held the little fist enclosed in his own. It was wet and sticky and very small, but felt reassuringly sturdy.
Fed she ducklings by the water, every morning just at 9, hit her foot against a splinter, fell into the foaming brine.
The eyelids fluttered briefly, then gave up the struggle and closed. Jemmy sighed and went completely limp, the heat coming off his skin in waves. Tiny beads of moisture trembled on each lash. Tears, sweat, steam, or all three.
Ruby lips above the water, blowing bubbles soft and fine. Alas for me, I was no swimmer, so I lost my Clementine. Oh, my darling, oh, my darling.
He wiped his face again, bent and kissed the soft thatch of damp, silky hair. Thank you, he thought, with heartfelt sincerity, addressing everyone from God on down the line.
Oh, my darling Clementine.
This ends Disc 23. The Fiery Cross, Disc 24.
Chapter 48. Strangers in the Night. It was very late by the time I made my way to bed after a last check on the welfare of all my patients. Duane Buchanan had suffered a slight flesh wound in the upper arm when Ronnie Campbell neglected to raise his pistol high enough while carousing on the river bank, but was in good spirits after having the wound cleaned and dressed. Having been liberally plied with further spirits by a remorseful Ronnie, he was quite literally feeling no pain at present. One of Farquhar Campbell's slaves, a man named Rastus, had been badly burned on the hand when taking grilled fowl off a skewer. All I could do there was to wrap the hand in clean cloth, set it in a bowl of cold water, and prescribe gin to be taken internally. I'd also treated several young men who were considerably the worse for drink, and sporting miscellaneous contusions, abrasions, and missing teeth as a result of a disagreement over dice. 6 cases of indigestion, all treated with peppermint tea and reporting improvement. Betty was in what looked like a deep but natural sleep, snoring loudly in bed. Jemmy was doing likewise, his fever abated. Most of the loud revelry had died down by now. Only the most die-hard of the card players were still at it, peering red-eyed at their pasteboards through a cloud of tobacco smoke in the small drawing-room. I glanced into the other rooms as well as I made my way across the ground floor to the front stair. A few gentlemen lingered in low-voiced political conversation at one end of the dining room, the table long since cleared and empty brandy glasses forgotten by their elbows. Jamie wasn't one of them. A heavy-eyed slave in livery bowed as I poked my head in, murmuring to ask whether I wanted food or drink. I hadn't eaten anything since supper. But I waved him away, too tired to think of food. I paused at the first landing and glanced down the hall toward Jocasta's suite of rooms. But all was quiet there, the charivari and horseplay over. There was a large dent in the linen fold panelling where a heavy body had struck, and glancing up, I could see several burned spots in the ceiling where shots had been fired into it. The butler, Ulysses, sat guard on a stool by the door, still dressed in wig and formal livery, head nodding over folded arms. A candle guttered and spat in the sconce above him. By its wavering light, I could see that his eyes were closed, but he wore a deep frown. He hunched in his sleep, and his lips moved briefly as though he dreamed of evil things. I thought to waken him, but even as I moved toward him, the dream passed. He stretched, half rousing, then fell asleep again, his face relaxing into calm. An instant later, the candle flickered out. I listened, but heard no sound in the darkness save Ulysses' heavy breathing. Whether Duncan and Jocasta murmured understandings to each other behind the curtains of their bed, or lay silent, side by side and eternally separate, no one would ever know. I sent them a mental wish for happiness, and dragged myself upward, knees and back aching, wishing for my own bed and my own husband's understanding. Through an open casement on the second floor landing, I heard distant whoops, laughter, and the occasional crack of recreational gunfire borne on the night air. The younger, wilder gentlemen, and a few old enough to know better, had gone down to the river landing in company with a dozen bottles of whiskey and brandy to shoot frogs, or so I was informed. The ladies, though, were all asleep. The second floor was quiet, save for the buzz of muffled snoring. By contrast to the chilly corridor outside, the chamber itself was stifling, though the fire had burned down to a crimson coal bed that shed no more than an eerie red glow across the hearth. With so many guests in the house, the only people with the luxury of a private bedroom were the bridal pair. Everyone else was crammed into the few available rooms willy-nilly. Two large tester beds and a trundle occupied the room, with straw-tick pallets spread over most of the remaining floor space. Each bed was packed like a sardine tin with shift-clad women lying side by side across the mattress, radiating as much moist heat as a greenhouse full of orchids. I breathed shallowly. The air was filled with a cloying mixture of stale sweat, barbecue and fried onions, French perfume, drink-sodden breath, and the sharp, sweet smell of vanilla beans, and shed my gown and shoes as quickly as I could, hoping not to break out into a drenching sweat before I could undress. I was still keyed up from the events of the day, but exhaustion was pulling like lead weights at my limbs, and I was glad enough to tiptoe through the sprawl of bodies and creep into my accustomed space near the foot of one of the big beds. My mind was still buzzing with speculations of all sorts, and in spite of the hypnotic lull of so much slumber all around me, I lay stiff-limbed and sore, watching the silhouette of my bare toes against the half-dying light. Betty had passed from her stupor into what looked like a normal deep sleep. When she woke in the morning, we would find out who'd given her the cup, and, perhaps, what was in it. I hoped that Jemmy would sleep comfortably as well. But what was really on my mind, of course, was Jamie. I hadn't seen him among the card players, nor yet among the men talking, low-voiced, of taxes and tobacco. I hadn't seen Philip Wiley anywhere on the first floor of the house either. I could well believe he was out with the revellers by the river landing. That was his set and his style. Wealthy young men who would seek diversion in drink and carouse in the dark, careless both of cold and danger, laughing and chasing each other by the light of random gunfire. That was neither Jamie's set nor his style, but the thought of him among them was what made my feet curl with chill despite the heat of the room. He wouldn't do anything stupid, I assured myself, rolling onto my side, knees drawn up as much as possible in the cramped quarters. He wouldn't. But his notion of stupid wasn't always the same as mine by any means. Most of the male guests were bedded down in the outbuildings or in the parlours as I passed. I had seen anonymous sleeping figures sprawled on the floor of the front parlour, snoring loudly, wrapped in their cloaks before the fire. I hadn't gone to poke among them, but doubtless Jamie was there. He had had as long a day as I had, after all. But it wasn't like him to retire without coming to wish me good night, no matter what the circumstances. Of course, he had been annoyed with me, and despite the promise of our interrupted conversation on the terrace, we hadn't quite made up the quarrel. Re-inflamed it, rather, with beastly Philip Wiley's invitation. My hands curled, thumbs rubbing at the slight calluses that marked the spots where my rings normally sat. Effing Scott. Next to me, Jemima Hatfield stirred and murmured, disturbed by my restlessness. I eased myself slowly back onto my side and stared sightlessly at the oaken footboard in front of me. Yes, he was undoubtedly still angry about Philip Wiley's advances. So was I, or I would be, were I not so tired.
How dare he?
I yawned, nearly dislocating my jaw, and decided it really wasn't worth the bother of being annoyed, at least not now. But it wasn't like Jamie to avoid me, angry or not. He wasn't the sort of man to sulk or brood. He would seek a confrontation or provoke a fight without a moment's hesitation, but I didn't think he'd ever let the sun go down on anger, at least not with regard to me. Which left me to worry about where he was and what in bloody hell he was doing. And the necessity of worrying about him was making me really angry, if only because that was better than being worried. But it had been a very long day, and as the moments passed and the faint pops of gunfire from the river landing gradually ceased, languor stole over me, blunting my fears and scattering my thoughts like spilled sand. The gentle breathing of the women all around me lulled me like the sound of wind in the trees, and my grip on reality slackened and at last fell free. I might have expected dreams of violence or nightmares of dread, but my subconscious had plainly had enough of that. In the contrary way of such things, it instead chose to dwell on another thread of the day's events. Perhaps it was the warmth of the room, or simply the closeness of so many bodies, but I dreamed vividly and erotically, the tides of arousal washing me now and then near to the shores of wakefulness, then, once more, carrying me out into the deeps of unconsciousness. There were horses in my dreams, glowing black Frisians with flowing manes that rippled in the wind as the stallions ran beside me. I saw my own legs stretch and leap. I was a white mare, and the ground flew past in a blur of green beneath my hooves, until I stopped and turned, waiting for the one, a broad-chested stallion who came to me, his breath hot and moist against my neck, his white teeth closing on my nape. "I am the King of Ireland," he said, and I came slowly awake, tingling from head to foot, to find that someone was gently stroking the sole of said foot. Still bemused by the carnal images of my dreams, I wasn't alarmed by this, but merely muzzily pleased to discover that I had feet after all and not hooves. My toes curled and my foot flexed, revelling in the delicate touch of the thumb that traced its way from the ball of my foot down the high arch and up into the hollow below my ankle bone, managing to stimulate an entire plexus of sensation. Then I came all the way awake with a small jerk. Whoever it was plainly sensed my return to consciousness, for the touch left my foot momentarily. Then it came back, this time more firmly, a large warm hand curling quite round my foot, the thumb executing a firm but languid massage at the base of my toes. By this time I was quite awake and mildly startled but not frightened. I wiggled my foot briefly as though to throw off the hand, but it squeezed my foot lightly in response, and then its companion gently pinched my great toe. This little piggy went to market. This little piggy stayed home. I could hear the rhyme as clearly as though it had been spoken aloud, as the fingers deftly pinched their way across my toes, one by one. And this little piggy went wee, 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 all the way home. The touch flicked tickling down the sole of my foot, and I jerked, an involuntary giggle caught in my throat. I lifted my head, but the hand seized my foot again and squeezed in admonition. The fire had gone out altogether, and the room was black as velvet. Even with eyes completely dark adapted, I could gain nothing but the sense of a hunched figure near my feet, an amorphous blob that shifted like mercury, its edges blending with and disappearing into the dark of the air. The hand slid gently up the calf of my leg. I twitched violently,
and the woman next to me snorted, reared up with a bleary, and collapsed again in a whoosh. My stomach muscles quivered with suppressed laughter. He must have felt the slight vibration. The fingers left my little toe with a gentle squeeze and stroked the bottom of my foot, making all my toes curl tight. The fingers curled into a fist, pressing along the length of my sole, then suddenly opened, cupping my heel. His thumb stroked my ankle and paused, questioning. I didn't move. His fingers were getting warmer. There was only a faint sensation of cold as they followed the curve of my calf and sought shelter in the soft place behind my knee. The fingers played a quick tattoo on the sensitive skin there, and I twitched in agitation. They slowed and stopped, settling surely on the artery where my pulse beat fast. I could feel it, blood rushing past where the skin was so thin the veins would show blue beneath it. I heard a sigh as he shifted his weight, then one hand cupped the round of my thigh and slid slowly upward. The other followed, pressing my legs gently, inexorably apart. My heart was thumping in my ears, and my breasts felt swollen, nipples poking hard and round through the thin muslin of my shift. I took a deep breath and smelled rice powder. All at once, my heart gave a double thump and nearly stopped as a sudden thought sprang to life in my mind. What if it wasn't Jamie? I lay quite still, trying not to breathe, concentrating on the hands which were doing something delicate and quite unspeakable. Large hands? They were large hands. I could feel the knuckles pressing the soft inner flesh of my thigh. But Philip Wiley had large hands too, quite large for his size. I had seen him scoop up a handful of oats for his stallion, Lucas, and the horse bury its big black nose in the palm. Calluses. The roving hands, oh God, were smoothly calloused. But so were Wiley's. Dandy he might be, but a horseman. His palms were quite as smooth and hard as Jamie's. It had to be Jamie, I assured myself, lifting my head an inch or so and peering into the black velvet darkness. 10 little pigs. Of course it was Jamie. Then one of the hands did something quite startling, and I gasped out loud and jerked, limbs twitching. My elbow slammed into the ribs of the woman next to me, who snapped upright with a loud exclamation. The hands retreated abruptly, squeezing my ankle in a hasty farewell. There was a shuffling noise as someone crawled hurriedly across the floor, then a flash of dim light and a breath of cold air from the corridor as the door opened and shut again immediately. "Wah!" said Jemima, next to me, in woozy astonishment. "Who's that?" Receiving no answer, she flounced, muttered, and at last lay down again to fall promptly fast asleep. I did not. Chapter 49. In Vino Veritas. I lay sleepless for quite a long time, listening to the peaceful snores and rustlings of my bedmates, and to the agitated thump of my own heart. Every nerve in my body felt as though it was sticking out through my skin, and when Jemima Hatfield rolled unconsciously into me, I jabbed her viciously in the ribs with my elbow, so that she uttered a startled "woof," and sat halfway up, blinking and muttering, before collapsing slowly back into the communal sea of sleep. As for me, my small bark of consciousness was adrift on the flood, spinning rudderless, but without the slightest chance of being pulled under. I simply couldn't decide how to feel. On the one hand, I was aroused, unwillingly to be sure, but still most definitely aroused. Whoever my nocturnal visitor had been, he knew his way around a woman's body. That would argue for its being Jamie, I thought. Still, I had no idea how experienced Philip Wiley might be in the arts of love. I had spurned his approaches in the stable so promptly that he had had no chance of demonstrating any skills he might possess in that direction.
But my midnight visitor hadn't used any caress that I could positively identify as being in Jamie's repertoire. Now, if he had used his mouth... I shied away from that line of thought like a spooked horse, and Jemima gave a muffled grunt as I convulsed slightly, my skin rippling in involuntary response to the images it evoked. I didn't know whether to feel amused or outraged, seduced or violated. I was extremely angry. I was sure of that much, at least, and the surety gave me some small anchor in the maelstrom of emotion. Still, I had no idea as to the correct target of my anger, and with nowhere to aim that particular destructive emotion, it was simply crashing round inside me, knocking things down and leaving dents. "Oof," said Jemima, in a pointed and quite conscious tone of voice. Evidently I wasn't the only one being dented by my emotions. "Hmm?" I murmured, feigning half-sleep. "Girl, zzzg." There was a small tinge of guilt in the mix as well. If I were sure it had been Jamie, would I be angry? The worst of it was, I realised, that there was absolutely nothing I could do to find out who it had been. I could scarcely ask Jamie whether he had crept in and fondled me in the darkness, because if he hadn't, his immediate response would certainly be to assassinate Philip Wiley barehanded. I felt as though tiny electric eels were squirming under my skin. I stretched as hard as I could, alternately tensed and relaxed every muscle, and still could find no way to keep still. At last I slid cautiously off the bed and made my way to the door with a glance at my erstwhile bedmates, who lay slumbering peacefully under the quilts like a row of perfumed sausages. Moving with great stealth, I eased the door open and peeked out into the hallway. It was either very late or very early. The tall window at the end of the corridor had gone to grey, but the last of the stars still showed, vanishing pinpoints on the charcoal satin of the sky. It was cold in the hall, away from the contained body heat of the women, but I welcomed the chill. The blood was pulsing just under my skin, and I bloomed with heat and agitation. A nice cool-down was exactly what I wanted. I made my way quietly to the back stairs, meaning to go down and outside for a breath of air. I stopped dead at the top of the staircase. A man stood at the foot of the stair, a silhouette tall and black against the panes of the double French doors. I didn't think I'd made any sound, but he turned at once, face lifted toward me. Even in the poor light, I knew at once that it was Jamie. He was still clad in the clothes he had worn the night before, coat and waistcoat, frilled shirt and buckled breeches. The shirt was open at the neck, though, coat and waistcoat unbuttoned and askew. I could see the narrow line of white linen, the flesh of his throat dark against it. His hair was loose. He'd been running his hands through it.
"Come down," he said softly.
I hesitated, looking back over my shoulder. A ladylike medley of snores came from the room I had just left. Two slaves were sleeping on the floor in the hall, curled under blankets, but neither moved. I looked back. He didn't speak again, but lifted two fingers, beckoning. The scent of smoke and whiskey filled the stairwell. The blood was thrumming in my ears and elsewhere. My face was flushed, my hair damp at the temples and on my neck. Cool air rose up under my shift, touched the patch of dampness at the base of my spine, the film of slickness where my thighs brushed together. I came down slowly, cautiously, trying not to let the stairs creak under my bare feet. It occurred to me belatedly that this was ridiculous. The slaves thundered up and down these stairs hundreds of times a day. Even so, I felt the need for secrecy. The house was still asleep, and the stairwell was filled with a grey light that seemed as fragile as smoked glass. A sudden sound, a move too quick, and something might explode under my feet with a flash like a light bulb popping. His eyes stayed fixed on me, dark triangles in the paler dark of his face. He stared at me with a fierce intensity as though to drag me down the stairs by the force of his gaze alone. I stopped, one step from the bottom. There was no blood on his clothes. Thank God for that. It wasn't that I'd never seen Jamie drunk before. No wonder he hadn't come up the stairs to me. I thought he was very drunk now, and yet there was something quite different in this. He stood, rock solid, legs set wide, betrayed only by a certain deliberation in the way he moved his head to look at me. "What?" I began, whispering.
"Come here," he said.
His voice was low, rough with sleeplessness and whiskey. I hadn't time either to reply or to acquiesce. He seized my arm and pulled me toward him, then swept me off the last step, crushed me to him, and kissed me. It was a most disconcerting kiss, as though his mouth knew mine all too well and would compel my pleasure, regardless of my desires. His hair smelled of a long night's smoke, tobacco and wood smoke, and the smoke of beeswax candles. He tasted so strongly of whiskey that I felt light-headed, as though the alcohol in his blood was seeping into mine through our skins where they touched, through the sealed membranes of our mouths. Something else was seeping into me from him as well, a sense of overpowering lust, as blind as it was dangerous. I wanted to remonstrate with him, to push him away. Then I decided that I didn't, but it wouldn't have made any difference if I had. He didn't mean to let go. One big hand was gripping the back of my neck, warm and hard on my skin, and I thought of a stallion's teeth closing on the neck of the mare he mounts, and shivered from scalp to sole. His thumb accidentally pressed the great artery under my jaw. Darkness swam behind my eyes, and my knees began to buckle. He felt it, and let go, easing me back so that I was almost lying prone upon the stairs, his weight half on me, and his hands seeking. I was naked under my shift, and the thin muslin might as well not have been there. The hard edge of a stair pressed into my back, and it occurred to me, in the dim way that things do when you're drunk, that he was just about to take me right there on the stairs, and devil take anyone who might see. I got my mouth free of his long enough to gasp, "Not here," in his ear. That seemed to bring him momentarily to his senses. He lifted his head, blinking like one roused from a nightmare, eyes wide and blind. Then he nodded once, jerkily, and rose, pulling me to my feet with him. The maid's cloaks were hanging by the door. He seized one and wrapped it round me, then picked me up bodily and shouldered his way through the door past a staring housemaid with a slop jar in her hands. He set me down when he reached the brick path outside. The bricks were cold under my feet. Then we were moving together through the grey light across a landscape of shadow and wind, still entangled with each other, stumbling, jostling, and yet somehow almost flying, clothes fluttering round us, and cold air brushing our skins with the rude touch of spring, bound for some vaguely sensed and yet inevitable destination. The stables. He hit the door and pulled me through with him into the warm dark, thrusting me hard against a wall.
"I must have you now, or die," he said, breathless.
And then his mouth was on mine again, his face cold from the air outside, and his breath steaming with mine. Then he drew abruptly away, and I staggered, pressing my hands against the rough bricks of the wall to keep my balance.
"Hold up your hands," he said.
"What?" I said, stupidly.
"Your hands. Put them up."
In complete bewilderment, I held them up, and felt him take hold of the left one, fumbling. Pressure and warmth, and the faint light from the open door shone on my gold wedding ring. Then he seized my right hand, shoved my silver ring onto my finger, the metal warm from the heat of his body. He raised my hand to his mouth and bit my knuckles hard. Then his hand was on my breast, cold air brushed my thighs, and I felt the scratch of the bricks on my bare backside. I made a noise, and he clapped a hand over my mouth. Speared as neatly as a landed trout, I was just as helpless, pinned flapping against the wall. He took his hand away and replaced it with his mouth engulfing mine.